Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 44 of The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 44. Chapter 5. The Dance of Death. Part 4. They did not mention the visit to Loro's bedside. Even to themselves they refrained from comment on his behaviour. But both were better pleased with their call upon Anton Karlovich Ferge from St. Petersburg, who lay in bed with his great good-natured beard and his just-as-good-natured-looking great Adam's apple, recovering slowly from the unsuccessful attempt which had been made to install the pneumothorax in his interior economy, and which had been within a hair's breadth of costing Herr Ferge his life on the spot. He had suffered a frightful shock, the pleuro shock, a quite frequent occurrence in cases where this fashionable technique was applied. But Herr Ferge's shock had been exceptionally dangerous, a total collapse and critical loss of consciousness, in a word, so severe an attack that the operation had been broken off at once and was indefinitely postponed. Herr Ferge's good-natured grey eyes grew large and round. His face went ashen-coloured when he came to speak of the operation, which must have been horrible indeed. "No anaesthesia, my dear sir. In this case it doesn't do. A sensible man understands that and accepts the situation as it is. But the local doesn't reach very far down. It only benumbs the surface flesh. You feel it when they lay you open, like a pinching and squeezing. I lie there with my face covered, so I can't see anything. The assistant holds me on one side and the directress on the other. I feel myself being pinched and squeezed. That is the flesh they are laying back and pegging down. Then I hear the Hofrat say, 'Very good.' And then he begins with a blunt instrument. It must be blunt, not to pierce through too soon, to go over the pleura and find the place where he can make an incision and let the gas in. And when he begins moving about over my pleura with his instrument, oh, Lord, I felt it was all up with me. It was something perfectly indescribable. The pleura, my friends, is not anything that should be felt of. It does not want to be felt of, and it ought not to be. It is taboo. It is covered up with flesh and put away once and for all. Nobody and nothing ought to come near it. And now he uncovers it and feels all over it. My God, I was sick at my stomach. Horrible, awful. Never in my life have I imagined there could be such a sickening feeling outside hell and its torments. I fainted. I had three fainting fits, one after the other. A green, a brown, and a violet. And there was a stink. The shock went to my sense of smell, and I got an awful stench of hydrogen sulphide, the way it must smell in the bad place. With all that, I heard myself laughing as I went off. Not the way a human being laughs. It was the most indecent, ghastly kind of laughing I ever heard. Because when they go over your pleura like that, I tell you what it is as though you were being tickled, horribly, disgustingly tickled. That is just what the infernal torment of the pleura shock is like, and may God keep you from it. Often, and never without blanching and shuddering, did Anton Karlovich Ferge come back to this infernal experience of his, and torture himself with it in retrospect. He had from the first professed himself a simple man. The higher things of this life, he said, were utterly beyond him. He expressly stipulated that no intellectual or emotional demands be made upon him. He, for his part, made none upon anybody else. This bargain once struck, he turned out to talk not unentertainingly of his experiences in the life from which his illness had withdrawn him. He had been in the employ of a fire insurance company, and made constant extended journeys from St. Petersburg up and down the whole of Russia, visiting insured factory buildings and spying out those which were financially suspect. For it was a fact supported by statistics that the larger percentage of fires occurred in just those factories where business was not going too well. Thus he was sent out to study a plant under this or that pretext and to render account to his company so that serious loss could be provided against betimes by increased counter-insurance or dividing the risk. He told of winter journeys through the length and breadth of Russia, of night travel in extreme cold, in sledges that you lay down in, under sheepskin covers, and when you roused, you could see the eyes of wolves gleaming like stars across the snow. He carried his provisions frozen, cabbage soup and white bread in boxes. When they stopped to change horses at a station, these could be thawed out as required, and the bread would be as fresh as on the day it was baked. But when there came a sudden mild spell, he would find that the soup he had brought with him in chunks had melted and run away. Thus Herr Ferge, now and then interrupting his narrative with a sigh, and the remark that it was all very well, if only they did not try the pneumothorax again. His talk was devoid of the higher things, but it was full of facts, and interesting to listen to, particularly for Hans Castorp, who found it profited him to hear about Russia and the life as it was lived there, about samovars and pirogues, Cossacks and wooden churches with so many towers shaped like onion tops as to look like a whole colony of mushrooms. He led Herr Ferge to talk about the people, the strange and exotic northern types with their Asiatic tincture, the prominent cheekbones and Finnish Mongolian slant to the eye, listening with anthropological interest to all that he heard. At his request, Herr Ferge spoke Russian to him. The outlandish, spineless, washed-out idiom came pouring from under the good-natured moustaches, out of the good-natured Adam's apple, and Hans Castorp enjoyed it the more, youth-like, because all this was, pedagogically considered, forbidden fruit he was tasting. He and Joachim spent many a quarter hour with Anton Karlovich. Also they visited the lad Teddy from the Fredericanum, a young exquisite of 14 years, blonde and elegant, with a private nurse, and arrayed in white silk corded pyjamas. He was rich, he told them, and an orphan. He was here awaiting the moment for a serious operation they intended to try, for the removal of certain infected parts. Now and again, when he had a good day, he would leave his bed and dress in his neat sports attire to mingle for an hour in the company below. The ladies liked to dally with him, and he listened to their talk, for example to that concerning Lawyer Einhof, the young lady in the combinations, and Franschen Oberdank. Then he would return to his bed. Thus idly and elegantly passed the time for the lad Teddy, and it was very plain that he expected nothing more from life than just this which he had. Then there was Frau Malenkrant, in number 50, Natalie by name, with the black eyes and the gold rings in her ears, coquettish, fond of dress, but a perfect Lazarus and Job in female form, whom God had pleased to afflict with every kind of infirmity. Her entire organism seemed infected, and she suffered from all possible complaints by turns and simultaneously. The skin was sympathetically involved, being covered in large tracts by an itching eczema, with open sores here and there, even on the mouth, which made feeding difficult. Then she suffered from internal inflammations of various kinds, of the pleura, the kidneys, the lungs, the periosteum, even of the brain, so that she was subject to loss of consciousness. Finally, cardiac weakness, the result of constant pain and fever, gave her the greatest distress, and even made it at times impossible for her to swallow, so that a mouthful of food would remain stuck in her throat. The woman's state was truly pitiable, and she was alone in the world, for she had left home and children for the sake of a lover, a mere youth, only to be forsaken in her turn. All this she herself related to the cousins, and now was without a home, if not without means, since her husband saw that she should not want. She accepted with no false pride the fruits of his charity, or his unquenched love, whichever it was, seeing herself quite humbly as a dishonoured and sinful creature, and so bore all the plagues of Job with astounding patience and resiliency, with the elementary powers of resistance of her sex, which triumphed over all the misery of her tawny body, and even made of the gauze dressings which she had to wear about her head a becoming personal ornament. She changed her jewels many times in the day, began with corals in the morning and ended at night with pearls. Hans Castorp's flowers greatly delighted her. She obviously regarded them as the expression of gallant rather than charitable sentiments, and invited both young men to tea in her room. She drank from an invalid cup, all her fingers decked to the joint with opals, amethysts, and emeralds. In no long time she had told her guests her story, the golden earrings swaying as she talked, told of her respectable, tiresome husband, her no less respectable and tiresome children, who were precisely like their father, and for whom she had not been able to feel great warmth of affection, of the half-boy, half-man with whom she had fled, whose poetic tenderness she never tired of describing. But his family had taken him away from her by guile and force commingled, and perhaps he too had been revolted by her illness, which had then suddenly and violently broken out. Perhaps the gentlemen were revolted too, she asked coquettishly, and her inborn femininity triumphed even over the eczema that covered half her face. Hans Castorp felt only contempt for the revolted lover, and expressed it by a shoulder shrug. The poetic youth's defection was as a spur to himself, and he began to take occasion to perform what services he could for the unhappy woman in the repeated visits he made to her room, services that required no nursing skill, as, for instance, feeding her the midday broth after his own meal, giving her to drink when the food stuck in her throat, helping her to change her position in bed. For to add to everything else, she had a wound from an operation which made lying difficult. He practised himself in these acts of benevolence, looking in on her on his way to the dining-hall, or when returning from a walk, and telling Joachim to go on ahead he would stop for a moment in number 50 to see after a case. He experienced a pleasing sense of expanded being, the fruit of his conviction that what he did was both useful in itself and possessed of a secret significance. There was also a malicious satisfaction he had in the blamelessly Christian stamp his activities bore. It was so clear that on no ground whatever, either the military or the humanistic or pedagogic, were they open to any serious reproach. It was some time after this that they took up Karen Karstedt, and both Hans Castorp and Joachim felt peculiarly drawn to her. She had been up here for years and was an outpatient of the Hofrat, who had commended her to the cousin's benevolence. She was entirely without private means and dependent upon unfeeling relatives. Once, in fact, they had taken her away, since she was sure to die in any case, and only at the Hofrat's intercession did they send her back. She lived in a modest pension in the village, a 19-year-old undersized little person with sleek, oily hair and eyes forever timidly trying to hide a brilliance that accorded only too well with the hectic flush on her cheek. Her voice had the characteristic huskiness, but was sympathetic. She coughed almost constantly, and all her finger ends were plastered up, as they had running sores. The Hofrat, then, had appealed to the cousins on Karen's behalf. They were such kind-hearted chaps, and they made her their especial ward, beginning with the gift of flowers, following on with a visit to the poor child upon her little balcony in the village, and continuing with various outings which the three took together to see a skating race or a bobsleigh competition. For the winter sports season was now at its height. There was a special week overcrowded with events, those feats and displays to which the cousins had previously paid only cursory attention. Joachim was averse from every kind of distraction up here. He was not here, he said, on their account. He was not here to enjoy life and to put up with his sojourn in the measure in which it furnished him agreeable change and diversion. He was here solely and simply to get well as quickly as he could, in order to join the service below, real service, not the service of the cure, which was but a substitute, though to be sure he grudged any falling off in the duty he owed it. He was forbidden to join in the sports, to go and gape at them he did not like. As for Hans Castorp, he took too seriously, in too stern and inward a sense, his own share in the life of those up here, to have a thought or a glance for the doings of people who made a sports station of the valley. But now his benevolent preoccupation with poor Fräulein Karstedt made some change in these views, and Joachim could hardly dissent without seeming unchristian. They fetched the patient at her humble lodging in glorious, frosty, sunny weather, and escorted her through the English Quarter, so named after the Hotel d'Angleterre, and along the main street, lined with luxurious shops. Sleighs were jingling up and down. There were hosts of people, the idle rich and pleasure-loving from all over the world, who filled the Kurhaus and the other hotels of the place, all hatless, all clad in sports costumes, which were the last word in elegance and beauty of fabric, all bronzed with winter sunburn and the glaring reflections from snowy slopes. All this world, including the cousins and their protégé, were betaking themselves to the rink, which lay in the depth of the valley, not far from the Kurhaus. In summer it was a meadow, used for football. Music was playing, the Kurhaus band, stationed in the gallery of the wooden pavilion, above the four-cornered racecourse. Beyond all lay the mountains, in deep snow, against a dark blue sky. Our young people passed through the entrance and the crowd that, seated in ascending tiers, surrounded the course on three sides. They found places for themselves and sat down to look on. The professional skaters, in close-fitting costumes of black tricot, with furred and braided jackets, cut figures, hovered and balanced, leaped and spun. A pair of virtuosi, male and female, professionals and hors concours, performed feats which they alone in all the world could perform, and evoked storms of applause and fanfares of trumpets. Six young men of various nationalities competed for the speed prize and laboured six times round the four-sided course, bent over, with their hands behind their backs, some with handkerchiefs tied round their mouths. A bell rang in the midst of the music, and the crowd would burst out now and again with shouts of encouragement and applause. It was a gay company, in which the three invalids, the cousins and their protégé, sat and looked about them. There were white-teethed Englishmen in Scotch caps, talking in French to highly-scented ladies, dressed from head to foot in bright-coloured woollens. Some of them even wore knickerbockers. Americans with small, neat heads, on which the hair was plastered down, pipe in mouth and wearing shaggy furs, the skin side out. Bearded, elegant Russians looking barbarically rich, and Malayan Dutchmen. All these sitting among the German and Swiss population, as well as a sprinkling of indeterminate types, all speaking French, perhaps from the Balkans or the Levant. Hans Castorp showed a certain weakness for this motley, semi-barbarous world, but Joachim put it aside as mongrel and questionable. At intervals there were events for children, who staggered over the course with a snowshoe on one foot and a ski on the other. In one race each boy pushed a girl before him on a shovel. In another the winner carried a lighted taper, and must arrive at the goal with it still burning, or must climb over obstacles in his path, or pick up potatoes with a tin spoon and deposit them in watering pots placed along the course. Everybody was in extravagant spirits. The richest children were pointed out, the prettiest and those from well-known families. There were the little daughter of a Dutch multimillionaire, the son of a Prussian prince, and a 12-year-old lad who bore the name of a champagne known the world over. Young Karen was gay with the rest, and coughed persistently as she laughed, clapping for joy and very gratitude her poor hands with the running finger ends. End of section 44. Section 45 of The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 45. Chapter 5. The Dance of Death. Part 5. The cousins took her to see the bobsleigh races as well. It was no distance to the terminus, either from Karen's lodging or from the Birkhoff, for the track came down from the Schatzalp and ended in the village, among the houses on the western slope. At that point a hut had been erected, where word was received by telephone of the departures up above. Then the slow sleds would come singly, with long intervals between, around the curves of the white course that shone metallic between frozen barriers of snow. The riders were men and women in white woollens, with gay-coloured scarves of all nationalities wound about them. They were all red and lusty, and it snowed into their faces as they came on. Sledges would skid and upset, rolling their riders into the snow, and the onlookers would take photographs of the scene. Here, too, music played. The spectators sat in small tribunes, or pressed upon the narrow path that had been shovelled alongside the course, or thronged the wooden bridges which spanned it, watching the sleds that from time to time whizzed beneath. This was the path taken by the corpses from the sanatorium above, Hans Castorp thought. Round these curves, under these bridges, they came, down, down to the valley below. He spoke of it to the others. They even took Karen one afternoon to the Bioscope Theatre in the Platz. She loved it also very much. The bad air they sat in was offensive to the three, used as they were to breathing the purest. It oppressed their breathing and made their heads feel heavy and dull. Life flitted across the screen before their smarting eyes. Life chopped into small sections, fleeting, accelerated, a restless, jerky fluctuation of appearing and disappearing, performed to a thin accompaniment of music, which set its actual tempo to the phantasmagoria of the past, and with the narrowest of means at its command, yet managed to evoke a whole gamut of pomp and solemnity, passion, abandon, and gurgling sensuality. It was a thrilling drama of love and death they saw, silently reeled off. The scenes, laid at a court of an Oriental despot, galloped past, full of gorgeousness and naked bodies, thirst of power and raving religious self-abnegation, full of cruelty, appetite and deathly lust, and slowing down to give a full view of the muscular development of the executioner's arms. Constructed, in short, to cater to the innermost desires of an onlooking international civilization. Set in Brynia's critic, Hans Castorp thought, and whispered as much to his cousin, would doubtless have sharply characterized what they saw as repugnant to a humanistic sense, and have scarified with direct and classic irony the prostitution of technical skill to such a humanly contemptible performance. On the other hand, Frau Storr, who was sitting not far from our three friends, seemed utterly absorbed. Her ignorant red face was twisted into an expression of the hugest enjoyment. And so were the other faces about them. But when the last flicker of the last picture in a reel had faded away, when the lights of the auditorium went up, and the field of vision stood revealed as an empty sheet of canvas, there was not even applause. Nobody was there to be applauded, to be called before a curtain and thanked for the rendition. The actors who had assembled to present the scenes they had just enjoyed were scattered to the winds. Only their shadows had been here. Their activity had been split up into millions of pictures, each with the shortest possible period of focus, in order to give it back to the present and reel it off again at will. The silence of the crowd, as the illusion passed, had about it something nerveless and repellent. Their hands lay powerless in the face of the nothing that confronted them. They rubbed their eyes, stared vacantly before them, blinked in the brilliant light, and wishing themselves back in the darkness, looked at sights which had had their day, and then, as it were, had been transplanted into fresh time, and bedizened up with music. The despot died beneath the knife, with a soundless shriek. Then came scenes from all parts of the world. The President of the French Republic, in top hat and cordon, sitting in a landau and replying to a speech of welcome. The Viceroy of India, at the wedding of a Rajah. The German Crown Prince, in the courtyard of a Potsdam garrison. There was a picture of life in a new Mecklenburg village, a cockfight in Borneo, naked savages blowing on nose horns, a wild elephant hunt, a ceremony at the court of the King of Siam, a courtesan street in Japan, with geishas sitting behind wooden lattices. Samoyeds, bundled in furs, driving sledges drawn by reindeer through the snowy wastes of Siberia. Russian pilgrims praying at Hebron. A Persian criminal under the knout. They were present at all these scenes. Space was annihilated, the clock put back, the then and there played on by music and transformed into a juggling, scurrying now and here. A young Moroccan woman in a costume of striped silk, with trappings in the shape of chains, bracelets and rings, her swelling breasts half-bared, was suddenly brought so close to the camera as to be life-sized. One could see the dilated nostrils, the eyes full of animal life, the features in play as she showed her white teeth in a laugh, and held one of her hands, with its blanched nails, for a shade to her eye, while with the other she waved to the audience, who stared, taken aback, into the face of the charming apparition. It seemed to see and saw not. It was not moved by the glances bent upon it. Its smile and nod were not of the present, but of the past, so that the impulse to respond was baffled, and lost in a feeling of impotence. Then the phantom vanished. The screen glared white and empty, with the one word Finis written across it. The entertainment was over. In silence the theatre was emptied. A new audience took the place of that going out, and before their eager eyes the cycle would presently unroll itself again. Incited by Frau Storr, who joined them at the exit, they paid a visit to the café at the Kurhaus, Karen clapping her hands in delighted gratitude. Here, too, there was music, a small red-uniformed orchestra, conducted by a Bohemian or Hungarian first violin, who stood apart from the others among the dancing couples and belaboured his instrument with frantic writhings of his body. Life here was mondaine. Strange drinks were handed at the tables. The cousins ordered orangeade for the refreshment of their charge and themselves, while Frau Storr took a brandy and sugar. The room was hot and dusty. At this hour, she said, the café life was not yet in full swing. The dancing became much livelier as the evening advanced, and numerous patients from the sanatoria, as well as dissipated folk from the hotels and the Kurhaus, many more than were here as yet, came later to join the fun. More than one serious case had here danced himself into eternity, tipping up the beaker of life to drain the last drop, and in dulce jubilo, suffering his final hemorrhage. The dulce jubilo became, on her unlettered lips, something extraordinary. The first word she pronounced dolce, with some reminiscence of her musical husband's Italian vocabulary, but the second suggested jubilee, or an attempt to yodel, or goodness alone knew what. The cousins both devoted themselves assiduously to the straws in their glasses while this Latin was given out. But Frau Storr took no offence. She began, drawing back her lips and showing her rodent-like teeth, to drop hints and make insinuations on the subject of the relations of the three young people. As far as poor Karen was concerned, it was all pretty obvious. And, as Frau Storr said, she could not but enjoy being chaperoned on her little outings by such fine cavaliers. But the other side was not so easy to come at. However, ignorance and stupidity notwithstanding, the creature's feminine intuition helped her to a glimpse, even though a partial and vulgarized one, of the truth. For she saw, and even teasingly aimed at the fact, that Hans Castorp was the cavalier, and young Zimpson merely in attendance. Further, for she was aware of the state of Hans Castorp's feelings towards Madame Schuscher, that he was playing the gallant to poor little Kasted because he did not know how to approach the other. It was a simple guess, lacking profundity and not actually covering all the facts of the case. In short, it was only too worthy of Frau Storr, and when she came out with it, flat-footed, he did not even answer, save by a faint smile and an impenetrable stare. So much was true, after all, that poor Karen did afford him a substitute, an intangible yet real support, as did the rest of his charitable activities. But at the same time they were an end in themselves, too. The inward satisfaction he experienced whenever he fed the afflicted Frau Malenkrankt her broth, or suffered Herr Ferge to tell him once more the tale of the infernal pleuroshock, or saw poor Karen clapping her ravaged and mortifying hands in grateful joy, was perhaps of a vicarious and relative kind. Yet it was none the less pure and immediate. It was rooted in a tradition diametrically opposed to the one Herr Settembrini, as pedagogue, represented, yet seemed to him, young Hans Castorp, for all that, not unworthy of having applied to it the placet experii. The little house where Karen Kastet lived lay near the railway track and the watercourse, on the way to the Dorf, quite conveniently for the cousins to fetch her after breakfast for the morning walk. Going thence toward the village, to arrive upon the main street, one had before one the little Schierhorn, and on its right three peaks, which were called the Green Towers, but were now covered, like the rest, with snow that gleamed blindingly in the sun. Still further to the right came the round summit of the Dorfberg, and a quarter of the way up its slope was visible the cemetery of the Dorf, surrounded by a wall, obviously commanding a fine view, very likely of the distant lake, and thus suggesting itself, naturally, as the goal of a promenade. Thither they went one lovely morning. Indeed, all the days now were lovely, with a hot sun, a sparkling frost, a deep blue windless air, and a scene that glittered whitely all abroad. The cousins, one of them brick-red in the face, the other bronzed, walked without overcoats, which would have been intolerable in this sunshine. Young Zimpson in sports clothes, with arctics. Hans Castorp in arctics as well, but with long trousers, not feeling worldly enough to don short ones. This was the new year, between the beginning and middle of February. Yes, the last figure in the date had changed since Hans Castorp came up here. It was written now with the next higher digit. The minute hand in time's clock had moved one space further on. Not one of the large spaces, not one which measured the centuries or decades. It was only the year that had been shoved forward by one figure. Though Hans Castorp had been up here not a whole year yet, but scarcely more than half a one, it had jerked itself on, as does the minute hand of certain large clocks, which only register by 5 minutes at a time, and was now pointing motionless, awaiting the moment to move forward again. But the hand that marked the months would have to move on for 10 spaces more, only 2 more, in fact, than it had moved since he came up here, for February did not count, being once begun, as money changed counts as money spent. To the graveyard, then, on the slope of the Dorfberg, the three wended their way. We tell it to complete the tale of their excursions. It was Hans Castorp's idea. Joachim probably had scruples at first, on the score of poor Karen, but in the end agreed that it was useless to pretend with her, or to carry out Frau Storr's cowardly policy of shielding her from all that could remind her of her end. Karen Karstedt was not yet so far on as to display the self-deception which marks the last stage. She knew quite well how it stood with her, and what the necrosis of her fingertips meant. Knew, too, that her unfeeling relatives would not hear of the unnecessary expense of having her sent back home, and that it would be her lot, after her exit, to fill a modest space up yonder. In short, it might even be said that such an excursion was more fitting, morally speaking, than many another, than the cinematograph or the bobsleigh races, for example, and surely it was no more than proper to make those lying up there a visit, once in a way, as a comradely attention, provided one did not regard it as in the same class with an ordinary walk or excursion to a point of interest. Slowly they went, in single file, up the narrow path that had been made in the snow, leaving the highest villas behind and below them, and watching the familiar scene unroll in its winter splendour, a little altered in perspective, and opening out to the northwest, toward the entrance of the valley. There was the hoped-for view of the lake, now a frozen and snow-covered round, bordered with trees. The mountains seemed to slope directly down to its furthest shore, while beyond these again showed unfamiliar peaks, all in full snow, overtopping each other against the blue sky. The young folk looked at the view, standing in the snow before the stone gateway to the cemetery. Then they entered through the ironwork grille, which was on the latch. Here, too, they found paths shovelled between the small enclosures, each of which was surrounded with its railing, each containing a number of graves. The snow rounded over and built up each smooth and even elevation, with its cross of stone or metal, its small monument adorned with medallions and inscriptions. No soul was to be seen or heard. The quiet remoteness and peace of the spot seemed deep and unbroken in more than one sense. A little stone angel or cupid, finger on lip, a cap of snow askew on its head, stood among the bushes, and might have passed for the genius of the place. The genius of a silence so definite that it was less a negation than a refutation of speech. The silence it guarded was far from being empty of content or character. Here it would have been in place for our two male visitors to take off their hats, had they had any on. But they were, even Hans Castorp, bareheaded, and could only walk reverently, their weight on the balls of their feet, making instinctive inclinations on one side and the other, single file in the wake of Karen Karstedt as she led the way. The cemetery was irregular in shape, having begun as a narrow rectangle facing the south, and then thrown out other rectangles on both sides. Successive increases in size had evidently been necessary, and ploughed land had been taken in. Even so, the present enclosure seemed fairly full, both along the wall and in the less desirable inner plots. One could hardly see or say just where another interment was to take place. The three wandered for some time discreetly along the paths, among the enclosures, stopping to decipher a name or date here and there. The tablets and crosses were modest affairs, which must have cost but little. The inscriptions bore names from every quarter of the earth. They were in English or Russian or other Slavic tongues, also German, Portuguese, and more. The dates told their own sad story, for the time they covered was generally a short span indeed, the age between birth and death averaging not much more than 20 years. Not crabbed age, but youth peopled the spot, folk not yet settled in life, who from all corners of the earth had come together here to take up the horizontal for good and all. Somewhere in the thick of the graves, near the heart of the acre, lay a small, flat, level place, the length of a man, between two rounded mounds, with wreaths of everlasting hanging on their headstones. Involuntarily, the three paused here, the young girl first, to read the mournful inscriptions. Hans Castorp stood relaxed, his hands clasped before him, his eyes veiled, and his mouth somewhat open. Young Zimpson, very self-controlled, and not only erect, but even bending a thought backward. And both the cousins stole a glance at Karen's face. She stood there, aware of their glance, with modest and shamefaced mien, her head bent on her shoulder, blinking her eyes, and smiling a strained little smile. End of section 45. Section 46 of The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 46. Chapter 5. Valpurgis Night. Part 1. Within the next few days it would be 7 months since Hans Castorp's advent among those up here, while Cousin Joachim, who had already had 5 to his credit, would soon be able to look back upon 12, that is to say, upon a whole round year. Round, indeed, in a cosmic sense, for since the doughty little locomotive had set him down at these heights, the earth had completed 1 full course round the sun, and was returned to the point whence it had then set out. The carnival season was at hand, and Hans Castorp inquired among the old inhabitants of the Birkhof what it would be like.
"Magnifique," answered Settembrini,
whom the cousins had again encountered on the morning walk.
"Gorgeous," he said, "every bit as lively as it is in the Prater. You shall see, engineer, the gayest gallants of the night, in brilliant rows, advancing," he quoted, and went on in his most mocking vein, couching his jibes in sounding phrases, with a telling accompaniment of arm, shoulder, and head movements. "What do you expect? Even in Maison de Santé they have their balls, for the fools and idiots, I've read. Why not up here as well? The programme includes various danses macabres, as you may imagine, but unfortunately some of last year's guests will not be here, the party being over at 9:30, you perceive."
"Do you mean—" "Oh, capital," laughed Hans Castorp. "Herr Settembrini, you are a wretch. 9:30, I say, did you get that?" He turned to his cousin. "Herr Settembrini means it would be too early for some of last year's guests to take part." "Spooky. He means the ones that have taken leave of the flesh, and the things of the flesh, in the meantime. But I am all excitement," he said. "I think it quite proper to celebrate the feasts up here as they come. Mark off the time in the usual way. Just a dead level of monotony, without any breaks at all, would be too awful for words. We have had Christmas already. We took notice of the beginning of the new year. And now comes Shrove Tuesday. After that, Palm Sunday. Holy Week, Easter. Then, 6 weeks after that, Whit Sunday. Then it is almost midsummer, the solstice, and we begin to go toward autumn."
"Stop, stop, stop,"
Settembrini cried, lifting his head up to heaven and pressing his temples with the palms of his hands.
"Be quiet. I cannot listen to you letting go the reins like that."
"Pardon me. I mean it just the other way. Behrens will finally have to make up his mind to the injections, to get rid of my infection. My temperature sticks at 99.3 degrees, to 4, 5, 6, and even 7. I am, and I continue to be, life's delicate child. I don't mean I am a long-termer. Rhadamanthus hasn't let me in for any definite number of months, but he did say it would be nonsense to interrupt the cure when I've been up here so long already, and invested so much time, so to speak. Even if he did set a term, what good would it do me? When he says, for instance, 1/2 a year, that is to be taken as the minimum. It is always more. Look at my cousin. He was to have finished the beginning of the month, finished in the sense of being healed, cured. And last time Baron saw him, he stuck on 4 more to make sure he is entirely sound. Well, then, where are we? Why, at the summer solstice, just as I said, without the faintest notion of offending you, and on the way to winter. Well, well, for the present, what we have before us is fashing, and, as I say, I consider it fit and proper to celebrate it in the usual way, just as it comes in the calendar. Frau Storr tells me the concierge sells tin horns in his lodge. Did you know that?" And so it fell out. Shrove Tuesday came on apace. Before one had actually seen it on the way, it arrived. All sorts of absurd instruments were snarling and squealing in the dining hall, even at early breakfast. At midday, paper snakes were launched from the table where Ganser, Rasmussen, and Fräulein Kleefeld sat. Paper caps were mounted. They, like the trumpets, were to be had of the concierge. The round-eyed Maroostia was among the first to appear in one. But in the evening, in the evening, there were festivities in the hall and the reception rooms, in the course of which, but we alone know to what, thanks to Hans Castorp's enterprising spirit, these carnival gaieties led up in their course. And we do not mean to let our knowledge betray us into indiscretion. We shall pay time all the honour due to it, and precipitate nothing. Nay, rather, we shall incline to protract the tale, out of feeling for young Hans Castorp's moral compunctions, which have so long prevented him from crossing his Rubicon. Everybody went down to the Platz in the afternoon to see the streets in carnival mood, with harlequins and columbines shaking their rattles, with maskers on foot and in jingling decorated sleighs, among whom went forward lively skirmishes and much confetti was flung. Spirits were very high at all seven tables where the guests assembled for the evening meal. There was every indication that the fun begun abroad would continue in the same key within doors. The concierge had done a thriving trade in rattles and tin trumpets. Lawyer Paravant had been the first to go further in the same line, putting on a lady's kimono and a braid of false hair belonging to Frau Consul General Wurmbrandt. He wore his moustaches drawn down on each side of his mouth with the tongs, and looked the very picture of a Chinaman, evoking loud applause from all quarters. The management had done its share. Each of the seven tables was decked with a paper lantern, a coloured moon with a lighted candle inside. When Settembrini entered and passed by Hans Castorp's, he quoted, "See the gorgeous tongues of fire, club as gay at heart's desire." He brought out the words with his fine dry smile, and sauntered to his place, where he was greeted with a rain of missiles, like tiny pellets, that broke and scattered a spray of perfume where they fell. Yes, from the first moment the key was high. The bursts of laughter were unremitted. Paper snakes hung down from the chandeliers, swaying to and fro. Confetti swam in the sauces. Very early the dwarf waitress brought in the first ice-pail, the first bottle of champagne. Inspired by lawyer Einhof, the guests drank it mixed with burgundy. Toward the end of the meal the ceiling light went out, and only the colourful twilight of the paper lanterns illumined the room, making of the scene an Italian night, and setting the crown upon the mood of the evening. Settembrini passed over a paper to Hans Castorp's table by the hand of Maroostia, who sat nearest him, with a green tissue-paper jockey cap on her head. On it he had written with a pencil, "But mind, the mountain's magic mad to-night, and if you choose a will-o'-wisp to light your path, take care, 'twill lead you all astray." This was received with enthusiasm, though Dr. Blumenkohl, whose state had now much altered for the worse, muttered something to himself, with the expression peculiar to him upon his face, or rather upon his lips. He seemed to be asking what sort of verses were these. But Hans Castorp considered that an answer was due. He felt it incumbent on him to cap the quotation, though it was unlikely he would have produced anything very striking. He searched his pockets for a pencil, but found none. Nor could Joachim or the schoolmistress supply his need, and his bloodshot eyes looked to the east for aid, to the further left-hand corner of the room. It was plain that his fleeting purpose was dissipated in a widening circle of associations. He paled a little, and entirely lost sight of his original intention. Other good ground there was for paling. Frau Schoscher had made special toilette for carnival. She wore a new gown, or at least one new to our hero, of thin, dark silk, probably black, or at most shot with a golden brown. It was cut with a modest little round neck, like a schoolgirl's frock, hardly so much as to show the base of the throat, or the collarbones, or the slightly prominent bone at the back of the neck, beneath the soft fringes of her hair. But it left free to the shoulder Claudia's arms, so tender and yet so full, so cool, so amazingly white, set off against the dark silk of her frock, with such ravishing effect that it made Hans Castorp close his eyes and murmur within himself, "Oh, my God!" He had never seen such a mode before. Ball gowns he had seen, stately and ceremonial, cut in conformity with a fashion that exposed far more of the person than this one did, without achieving a jot of his sensational effect. Poor Hans Castorp! He was reminded of a theory he had once held about these arms, on making their acquaintance for the first time, veiled in diaphanous gauze, that it was the gauze itself, the illusion, as he called it, which had lent them their indescribable, unreasonable seductiveness. Folly! The utter, accentuated, blinding nudity of these arms, these splendid members of an infected organism, was an experience so intoxicating compared with that earlier one as to leave our young man no other recourse than again, with drooping head, to whisper, soundlessly, "Oh, my God!" Later on, another paper was handed over, on which was written, "Society to Heart's Desire, in faith of bride's a party, and jolly bachelors on fire, with forward hopes and hearty." "Bravo, bravo!" they shouted. They were drinking coffee by now, served in little brown earthenware jugs, and some of them liqueurs as well, for instance Frau Storr, who adored the sweet and spirituous. The company began to rise from table, to move about, to pay visits. Part of the guests had already moved into the reception rooms. Others remained seated, still faithful to the drink they had mingled. Settembrini, coffee-cup in hand, sporting his toothpick, crossed over and sat down between Hans Castorp and the schoolmistress. "The Harz," he said, "near Schirk and Elend. Did I exaggerate, engineer? Here's a bedlam for you. But wait, the fun is not over so soon. Far from leaving off, it has not even reached its height. From what I hear, there will be more masquerading. Certain people have left the room. We are justified in anticipating almost anything." Even as he spoke, new maskers entered. Women dressed as men, with beards and moustaches of burnt cork, betraying themselves by their figures and looking like characters in comic opera. Men in women's clothes, tripping over their skirts. Here was the student Rasmussen, in a black jet-trimmed toilette, displaying a pimpled décolleté and fanning himself front and back with a paper fan. There was a Pierrot, costumed in white underwear, with a lady's felt hat, a powdered face that gave his eyes an unnatural expression, and lips garish with blood-red pomade, the youth with the fingernail. A Greek from the bad Russian table, who rejoiced in beautiful legs, strutted in tights with short cloak, paper ruff and dagger, personating a fairy prince or a Spanish grandee. All these costumes had been improvised since the end of the meal. Frau Storr could sit still no longer. She too disappeared, and presently returned, dressed as a charwoman, with skirt looped up and sleeves rolled back, a paper cap tied under her chin, armed with pail and brush. She began scrubbing about under the tables, among the feet of those still sitting. "See Bedlam Bobo, riding now," quoted Settembrini as she appeared, and gave the next line too in his clear and plastic delivery. She heard it, and retorted by calling him a turkey-cock, and bidding him keep his filthy jokes to himself. With the license of the season, she addressed him, Herr Settembrini, with the thou. But indeed this familiarity had become quite general during the meal. He girded himself to reply when a fresh stir and laughter in the hall interrupted him, and those in the dining-room looked up expectantly. Followed by a troop of guests, two singular figures entered. One was dressed like a nurse, but her black uniform was marked off from head to foot by short white strips close under each other, with a longer one at regular intervals, like degrees on a thermometer. She had one finger laid to her pallid lips, and in the other hand a fever chart. Her companion was all in blue, with blue paint on lips, brows, throat, cheeks and chin, and a blue woollen cap awry over one ear. He was dressed in a pullover of glazed blue linen, tied round the ankles and stuffed out into a great paunch round the middle. These were Frau Iltis and Herr Albin. They wore cardboard placards on which were written The Silent Sister and The Blue Peter. Together with sidling gait, they moved through the room. What applause there was! What ringing shouts! Frau Storr, her broom under her arm and her hands on her knees, laughed like the charwoman she impersonated. Only Settembrini was unmoved. He cast one glance at the successful maskers, and his lips became a fine thin line beneath the waving moustaches. Among the troop, streaming in the rear of the blue and silent ones, came Claudia Shosha, together with the woolly-haired Tamara and the man with the hollow chest, named Bulligin, who was dressed in evening clothes. Claudia brushed Hans Castorp's table with the folds of her new gown and crossed the room to where young Ganser and the Kleefeld were sitting. Her companions followed the rout out of the dining-hall after the two allegorical maskers, but she stood there, her hands behind her back, laughing and chatting, her eyes like narrow slits. She, too, had mounted a cap. It was not a bought one, but the kind one makes for children, a simple cocked hat of white paper, set rakishly on her head, and suiting her, of course, to a marvel. Her feet showed beneath the dark golden-brown silk of her frock, whose skirt was somewhat draped. Of her arms we shall say no more in this place. They were bare to the shoulder. "Look at her well," Hans Castorp heard Herr Settembrini say, as though from a distance, following her with his glance as she presently left the room. "The fair one, see? Lilith."
"Who?" asked Hans Castorp.
Herr Settembrini's literary soul was pleased. He answered, "Adam's first wife, is she?" Besides themselves, there was only Dr. Blumenkohl at the table, sitting in his place at the other end. Everyone else, even Joachim, was now in the drawing-rooms. Hans Castorp said, and he too addressed his companion with the license of the season, and said thou to him, "Dear me, you're full of poetry tonight. What lily do you mean? Did Adam marry more than once? I didn't know it."
"According to Hebraic mythos, Lilith became a night-tripping fairy, a belle dame sans merci, dangerous to young men, especially on account of her beautiful tresses."
"What the deuce, a hobgoblin with beautiful tresses? You couldn't stand that, could you? You would come along and turn on the electric light and bring the young men back to the path of virtue. That's what you do, isn't it?" Hans Castorp said whimsically. He had drunk rather freely of the mixed burgundy and champagne.
"Hark ye, engineer, and take heed what I say," Herr Settembrini answered, frowning. "You will kindly address me with the accepted form employed in the educated countries of the West, the third person pluralis, if I may make bold to suggest it."
"Why, isn't this carnival? The other is the accepted form everywhere tonight."
"Yes, it is, and its charm lies in its very abandon. When strangers, who would regularly use the third person, speak to each other in the second, it is an objectionable freedom. It is wantonly playing with the roots of things, and I despise and condemn it, because at the bottom the usage is audaciously and shamelessly levelled against our civilization and our enlightened humanity. Do not for one moment imagine I addressed you with this form just now. I was quoting from the masterpiece of your national literature. I used poetic license."
"So did I. I am using a sort of poetic license now, because it seems to me to suit the occasion, and that is why I do it. I don't say I find it perfectly natural and easy to say thou to you. On the contrary, it costs me an effort. I have to poke myself up to it. But I do so freely, gladly, and with all my heart."
"With all your—"
"Yes, quite sincerely, with all my heart. We have been up here for some time together. Do you realize it is 7 months? That is not much, perhaps, as they reckon time here, but in the ordinary way it is a good deal, after all. Well, we have spent it with each other, because life brought us together. We have met almost daily, and had interesting conversations, in part upon subjects of which, down below, I should not have had the faintest understanding. But up here I have. They seem to me very real and pertinent. And I was always very keen in our discussions, or rather when you explained things to me as a homo humanus, for of course I was too inexperienced to contribute anything, and could only feel that all you said was highly worth listening to. It is through you I have learned to understand such a lot. That about Carducci was the least part of it. Take the Republic and the Bello Stile, and how they hang together, or time with human progress, and how if there was no time there could be no human progress, and the world would only be a standing drain and stagnant puddle. What should I have known of all that if it weren't for you? So I simply address you as though we were old and close friends, without further ceremony, and you must excuse me because I don't know any other way. You sit there, and I speak to you like this, and it is all that's necessary, for you are not, to me, just any man with a name like another. You are a representative, Herr Settembrini, an ambassador to this place and to me. Yes, that is what you are. Hans Castorp asserted, and struck the table with the flat of his hand. "So now I will thank you," he went on, and shoved his champagne and burgundy along the table towards Herr Settembrini's coffee cup, as though to touch glasses with him. "I thank you for having taken trouble for me in these 7 months, for having lent a hand to a young donkey in all the new experiences that came to him, and tried to influence him for his good. Sine pecunia, of course, partly by means of anecdote and partly in abstractions. I distinctly feel the moment has come to thank you for all you have done, and to beg your pardon for being a troublesome pupil. A difficult, no, a delicate child of life, that was what you called me. It touched me very much to have you say that, and I feel touched every time I think of it. The troublesome child that I have been for you in your capacity as pedagogue. You remember you came to speak of that on the first day we met. It is one of the associations you have taught me, the relation between humanism and pedagogy, and there are many others I shall think of as time goes on. You must forgive me, then, and not think too hardly of me. I drink your health, Herr Settembrini. I drink to those literary endeavours of yours for the elimination of human suffering." He ceased speaking, bent over and drained his glass, hiccuped twice, and stood up. "Now let us join the others." End of section 46. Section 47 of The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 47. Chapter 5. Valpurgis Night. Part 2. "Why, engineer, what has come over you?" the Italian asked in surprise, rising in his turn. "That sounds like a parting."
"A parting? No, why?" Hans Castorp evaded him, not only in words but in action, for he turned as he spoke, describing a curve with the upper part of his body, and coming to a stop before Fraulein Engelhardt, who had just entered to fetch them. She said that a carnival punch, contributed by the management, was being dispensed by no less a person than the Hofrat himself, and bade them come, if they cared for a glass. So they went together. The little round white-covered table, with Hofrat Behrens behind it, stood the centre of a press of guests, each holding out a sherbet cup to be filled, into which the dispenser ladled the steaming drink out of a tureen. He, too, had made concessions to the carnival spirit. He wore his usual white surgeon's coat, for even today his professional activity must go on. But he had added a genuine Turkish fez, crimson, with a black tassel dangling over one ear. His appearance, of itself sufficiently striking, needed no more than this to render it quite outlandish. The long white smock exaggerated his height. One felt that if he were to stand erect and hold up his head, he would be more than life-size, and atop was the small head, with its high colour and unique cast of feature. Never before had Hans Castorp been so impressed with its oddity as when he saw it today under this absurd headgear. The flat, snub-nosed, purple-flushed physiognomy, the watery, goggling blue eyes beneath tow-coloured brows, and the blonde, close-trimmed moustache mounted crookedly above the full, bow-shaped lips. Turned away from the steam that wreathed upward from the bowl, he held the ladle high and let the sweet arrack punch run in a brown flowing stream into the glasses they held toward him, rattling on the while with his usual flow of whimsical jargon. "Herr Urien sits up above," Settembrini interpreted in a low voice with a wave of the hand. Dr. Krakowski was there too, short, stout, solid, with black alpaca shirt fastened like a domino on his shoulders, the sleeves dangling. He was holding the punch glass with his hand at the level of his eyes and twisting the wrist round as he talked and gestured with a group of masqueraders. Music was heard. The tapir-faced lady was playing Handel's Largo on the violin, and then a drawing-room sonata by Grieg, characteristically northern in mood. The Mannheimer accompanied her on the piano. There was good-natured applause, even from the bridge tables, which had been set up and occupied by maskers, with bottles in coolers at their sides. The doors were all open, and some of the guests stood in the hall as well. A group about the punch-table watched the Hofrat, who was introducing a new diversion. Bent over the table, with his eyes closed and his head thrown back in evidence of good faith,
He was sketching with his mighty hand a figure on the back of a visiting card, the outline of a pig. It was rather more fanciful than realistic, yet undoubtedly the lineaments of a pig, which under these difficult conditions, without the help of his eyes, he had managed to trace. It was a feat, and he could perform it. The little eyes were almost in the right place, so was the pointed ear, and the tiny legs under the rounded little belly. The curving line of the back ended in a small, neat ringlet of tail. There was a general "ah" as he finished. Then everyone was fired with an ambition to emulate the master. What abortions were brought forth! They lacked all coherence. The eyes were outside the head, the legs inside the paunch. The line of the latter came nowhere near joining. The little tail curled away by itself without organic connection with the figure, an independent arabesque. They nearly split with laughing. The group increased. The notice of the bridge party was attracted. The players were drawn by curiosity and came up holding their cards fan-shaped in their hands. The bystanders watched the performer to see he did not wink, which his feeling of powerlessness made him sometimes do. They giggled and guffawed while he committed his frantic blunders, and burst out in extravagant mirth when he at last opened his eyes and looked down upon his ridiculous handiwork. Blatant self-confidence lured everyone on to try his hand. The card, a large one, was soon filled on both sides with overlapping failures. The Hofrat contributed a second from his case, whereupon Lawyer Paravant, after taking thought, essayed to draw a pig without lifting the pencil. And lo, the measure of his unsuccess led all the rest. His creation had no faintest likeness either to a pig or to anything else on the broad earth. It was greeted with hilarity and boisterous congratulations. Menu cards were fetched from the dining-room, and now several people could draw at the same time, each performer having his own circle of onlookers and aspirants waiting for the pencil he was using. There were three pencils. They snatched them out of each other's hands. The Hofrat, having set the sport afoot and seen it thriving, withdrew with his adjutants. Hans Castorp stood in the thick of the crowd at Joachim's back, watching. He rested his elbow on his cousin's shoulder and supported his chin with all five fingers of that hand, his other arm set akimbo on his hip. He was talking and laughing, anxious to try his skill, asked on all sides for a pencil, and at length received a stump of a thing hardly to be held between thumb and forefinger. Then he shut his eyes, lifted his face to the ceiling, and drew, all the time uttering objurgations against the pencil, some horrible inanity upon the paper, in his haste spoiling even this, and running off the paper onto the tablecloth. "That doesn't count," he cried, as his audience burst out in well-merited jeers. "What can you do with a pencil like that? Deuce take it!" And he flung the offending morsel into the punch-bowl. "Has anybody a decent one? Who will lend me a pencil? I must have another try. A pencil, a pencil, who has a pencil?" he shouted, leaning with his left hand on the table and shaking the other high in the air. There was no answer. Then he turned, and passing through the rooms, went straight up to Claudia Schoscher, who, as he was well aware, was standing near the door of the little salon, watching with a smile the throng round the punch-table. Behind him he heard someone calling, euphonious words in a foreign tongue.
"Eh, Ingegenia, aspetti, che cosa fa? Ingegenia! A poi di regioni sa, mai matto questo ragioso."
But he drowned out the voice with his own, and Herr Settimbrini, flinging up his hand with a swing of the arm, a gesture common in his own country, whose meaning it would be hard to put into words, and giving vent to a long-drawn "eh, eh," turned his back on the room and the carnival gaieties. But Hans Castorp was standing on the tiled court of the school yard, gazing at close quarters into those blue-grey-green epicanthus eyes above the prominent cheekbones, and saying, "Do you happen to have a pencil?" He was deadly pale, as pale as when he had come back, blood-spattered, to the lecture from that walk of his. The nerves controlling the blood vessels that supplied his face functioned so well that the skin, robbed of all its blood, went quite cold. The nose looked peaked, and the hollows beneath the young eyes were lead-coloured, like any corpses. And the sympathicus caused his heart, Hans Castorp's heart, to thump in such a way that it was impossible to breathe, except in gasps. And shivers ran over him, due to the functioning of the sebaceous glands, which, with the hair follicles, erected themselves. She stood there, in her paper cap, and looked him up and down with a smile that betrayed no trace of pity, nor any concern for the ravages written on his brow. The sex knows no such compassion, no mercy for the pangs that passion brings. In that element the woman is far more at home than the man, to whom, by his very nature, it is foreign. Nor does she ever encounter him in it, save with mocking and malignant joy. Compassion, indeed, he would have none of. He had used the second person singular. She answered, "I? Perhaps I have. Let me see." Her voice and smile did betray an excitement, a consciousness, such as comes when the first word is uttered in a relationship long secretly sustained, a subtle consciousness which concentrates all the past in a single moment of the present. "You are so eager. You are very ambitious." She continued thus to mock him, in her slightly veiled, pleasantly husky voice, with her quaint pronunciation, giving a foreign sound to the R, and making the vowels too open, even accenting the word ambitious on the first syllable with exotic effect, rummaging and peering the while in her leather bag, when she fetched out first a handkerchief and then a little silver pencil, slender and fragile, a pretty trinket, scarcely meant for use. The other, the first one, had been something more to take hold of. "Voila," she said, and held the toy by its end before his eyes, between thumb and forefinger, and lightly turned it to and fro. Since she both gave and withheld it, he took it, so to speak, without receiving it. That is, he held out his hand, with the fingers ready to grasp the delicate thing, but actually not touching it. His eyes, in their leaden sockets, went from the little object to Claudia's Tartar physiognomy. His bloodless lips were open, and so remained. He did not use them to utter the words, as he said, "You see, I knew you would have one."
"Prenez garde, il est un peu fragile," she said. "C'est avisé, tu sais."
Their heads bent over it together, and she showed him the mechanism. It was quite ordinary. The little needle of hard, probably worthless lead, came down as one loosened the screw. They stood bent toward each other. The stiff collar of his evening dress served him to support his chin.
"A poor thing, but yours," he said, brow to brow with her, speaking down upon the pencil, stiff-lipped so that most of the labials went unsounded. "Ah, you are even witty," she answered him with a short laugh.
She straightened up and surrendered the pencil. It is a question by what means he was witty, since it was plain there was not a drop of blood in his head.
"Well, away with you. Go and draw. Draw yourself out."
And wittily in her turn she seemed to drive him away.
"But you have not drawn yet. You must draw too," he said, without managing the M in must, and drew a step backwards, invitingly. "I?" she said again, with an inflection of surprise which seemed to have reference to something else than his invitation.
She stood a moment in smiling confusion, then, as if magnetized, followed him a few steps toward the punch-table. But interest in the activity there seemed to have fallen away. Someone was still drawing, but without an audience. The cards were covered with futilities. They had all done their worst, and now the current had set in another direction. Directly the doctors had left the scene, the word had gone round for a dance. Already the tables were being pushed back. Spies were posted at the doors of the writing and music rooms, with orders to give the sign in case the old man, Krakowski, or the Oberon, should show themselves. A young Slavic youth attacked con expressione, the keyboard of the little nutwood piano, and the first couple began to turn about within an irregular circle of chairs and tables on which the spectators perched themselves. Hans Castorp dismissed the departing punch-table with a wave of the hand, and indicated with his chin two empty seats in a sheltered corner of the small salon near the portières. He did not speak, perhaps because the music was too loud. He drew up a seat. It was a reclining chair with plush upholstery for Frau Schorscher in the corner he had indicated, and took for himself a creaking, crackling basket-chair with curling arms, in which he sat down, bent forward toward her, his own arms on the arms of the chair, her pencil in his hand and his feet drawn back under his seat. She lay buried in the plushy slope, her knees brought high, notwithstanding which she crossed one leg over the other and swung her foot in the air, with its black patent leather shoe and black silk stocking spanned over the ankle bone. There was a coming and going in the room, some of the guests standing up to dance while others took their places to rest. "You've a new frock on," he said, as an excuse for looking at her, and heard her answer.
"New? So you are acquainted with my wardrobe."
"Am I right?"
"Yes, I had it made lately. The tailor down in the village, Lubacek, did it. He does work for several of the ladies up here. Do you like it?"
"Very much," he said, surveying her once more, and then casting down his eyes.
"Would you like to dance?" he added. "Would you like to?"
she asked, with lifted brows, yet smiling, and he answered,
"I would if you wished." "That is not so brave as I thought you were," she said, and when he laughed deprecatingly, she went on, "Your cousin has gone up already."
"Yes, he is my cousin," he confirmed her, unnecessarily. "I noticed he had gone. He is probably in the rescue by now."
"C'est un jeune homme très adroit, très honnête, très allemand."
"Adroit, honnête?" he repeated. "I understand French better than I speak it. You mean he is pedantic? You think we are pedantic, we Germans? Nous autres Allemands?
Nous causons de votre cousin. Mais c'est vrai, you are a little bourgeois. Vous aimez l'ordre mieux que la liberté. Tout l'Europe le sait."
"Aimer, aimer, qu'est-ce que c'est? Ça manque de définition, ce mot-là. We love what we have not. That is proverbial," Hans Castorp asserted. "Lately," he went on, "I've thought very much about liberty. That is, I've heard the word so often, I've begun to think about it. Je te le dirai en français, what I have been thinking. Ce que toute l'Europe nomme la liberté, c'est peut-être une chose assez pédante et assez bourgeoise en comparaison de notre besoin d'ordre. C'est ça.
Tiens, c'est amusant. C'est ton cousin à qui tu penses à disant des choses étranges comme ça?
No, c'est vraiment une bonne âme, a simple nature, not exposed to intellectual dangers, tu sais. Mais il n'est pas bourgeoise, il est militaire." "Not exposed," she repeated his word, not without difficulty.
"Tu veux dire une nature tout à fait ferme sur elle-même? Mais il est sérieusement malade, ton pauvre cousin."
"Who told you so?"
"We all know about each other up here."
"Was it Hofrat Behrens?"
"Peut-être on me faisait voir ce tableau."
"C'est-à-dire en faisant ton portrait."
"Pourquoi pas? Tu l'as trouvé réussi, mon portrait?"
"Mais oui, extrêmement. Behrens a très exactement rendu ta peau. Oh, vraiment, très fidèlement.
J'aimerais beaucoup être portraitiste.
Moi aussi, pour avoir l'occasion d'étudier ta peau comme lui."
"Parlez allemand, s'il vous plaît."
"Oh, I speak German, even in French. C'est une sorte d'étude artistique et médicale, en un mot. Il s'agit des lettres humaines, tu comprends. What do you say, shall we dance?"
"Oh, no, it would be childish, behind their backs. Aussitôt que Behrens reviendra, tout le monde va se précipiter sur les chaises. Ce sera fort ridicule."
"Have you such respect for him as that?"
"For whom?"
she said, giving her query a curt, foreign intonation. "For Behrens."
"Mais va donc avec ton Behrens. There really is not room to dance. Et puis, sur le tapis, let us look on."
"Yes, let's," he assented, and gazed beyond her with his blue eyes, his grandfather's musing eyes, in his pale young face, at the antics of the masked patients in salon and writing-room. There was the silent sister, capering with the blue Peter. There was Frau Solomon, as master of ceremonies, dressed in evening clothes, with a white waistcoat and swelling shirt-front. She wore a monocle, with a tiny painted moustache and twirled upon tiny high-heeled patent leather shoes that came out oddly beneath her black trousers as she danced with the Pierrot, whose blood-red lips stared from his ghastly white face with the eyes of an albino rabbit. The Greek flourished his symmetrical legs in their lavender tights alongside the darkly glittering Rasmussen in his low-cut gown, Lawyer Paravant in his kimono. Frau Consul General Wurmbrandt and young Ganser danced all three together, with their arms round each other. As for Frau Storr, she danced with her broom, pressing it to her heart and caressing the bristles as though they were a man's hair. End of section 47. Section 48 of The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 48. Chapter 5. Valpurgis Night. Part 3. "Yes, let's," Hans Castorp repeated mechanically. They spoke in low tones, covered by the music. "Let us sit here and look on, as though in a dream, for it is like a dream to me that we are sitting like this. Comme un rêve singulièrement profond, car il faut dormir très profondément pour rêver comme cela. Je veux dire, c'est un rêve bien connu, rêve de tout temps, long, éternel. Oui, être assis près de toi comme à présent, voilà l'éternité." "Poète," she said, "bourgeois, humaniste et poète. Voilà l'Allemand au complet, comme il faut. Je crains que nous ne soyons pas de tout et nullement comme il faut," he answered. "Sous aucun égard, nous sommes peut-être des delicate children of life, tout simplement." "Joli mot. Dis-moi donc, il n'aurait pas été fort difficile de rêver ce rêve-là plus tôt. C'est un peu tard que monsieur se reçut d'adresser la parole à son humble servante." "Pourquoi des paroles?" he said. "Pourquoi parler? Parler, discourir, c'est une chose bien républicaine, je le concède. Mais je doute que ce soit poétique au même degré. Un de nos pensionnaires, qui est un peu devenu mon ami, monsieur Settembrini, il vient de te lancer quelques paroles. Eh bien, c'est un grand parleur, sans doute. Il aime même beaucoup à réciter de beaux vers. Mais est-ce un poète, cet homme-là? Je regrette sincèrement de n'avoir jamais eu le plaisir de faire la connaissance de ce chevalier."
"Je le crois bien."
"Ah, tu le crois? Comment? C'est une phrase tout à fait indifférente, ce que j'ai dit là. Moi, tu le remarques bien, je ne parle guère le français. Pourtant, avec toi, je préfère cette langue à la mienne, car pour moi, parler français, c'est parler sans parler, en quelque manière, sans responsabilité, ou comme nous parlons en rêve, tu comprends?
Un peu près.
Ça suffit. Parlez," went on Hans Castorp.
"Pauvre affaire. Dans l'éternité, on ne parle pas. Dans l'éternité, tu sais, on fait comme en dessinant un petit cochon. On penche la tête en arrière et on ferme les yeux.
Pas mal, ça. Tu es chez toi dans l'éternité. Sans aucun doute, tu le connais au fond. Il faut avouer que tu es un petit rêveur assez curieux."
"Et puis," said Hans Castorp, "si je t'avais parlé plus tôt, il m'aurait fallu de dire « vous ».
"Eh bien, est-ce que tu as l'intention de me tutoyer pour toujours ?"
"Mais oui, je t'ai tutoyé de tout temps. Et je te tutoyerai éternellement."
"C'est un peu fort, par exemple. En tout cas, tu n'aurais pas trop longtemps l'occasion de me dire tu. Je vais partir."
It took time for the words to penetrate his consciousness.
Then he started up, staring about him as though roused out of a dream. The conversation had proceeded rather slowly, for Hans Castorp spoke French uneasily, feeling for the sense. The piano had been silent a while. Now it sounded again, under the hands of the man from Mannheim, who had relieved the Slavic youth. He put some music in place, and Fräulein Engelhardt sat down beside him to turn the leaves. The party was thinning out. Many of the guests had presumably taken up the horizontal. From where they sat they could see no one, but there were players at the card tables in the writing-room. "You are going to—" "What?" Hans Castorp asked, quite dashed.
"I am going away," she repeated, smiling with pretended surprise at his discomfiture.
"Impossible," he said. "You are jesting."
"Not at all. I am perfectly serious. I am leaving."
"When?"
"Tomorrow. Après dîner."
There took place within him a feeling of general collapse. He said,
"Where?" "Far away."
"To Dagestan?"
"Tu n'es pas mal instruit, peut-être, pour le moment."
"You are cured, then?"
"Quant à ça,
non.
But Berens thinks there is not greatly more to be gained here for the present. C'est pourquoi je vais risquer un petit changement d'air."
"Then you are coming back?"
"That is the question, or rather, the question is when. Quant à moi, tu sais, j'aime la liberté avant tout, et notamment celle de choisir mon domicile. Tu ne comprends guère ce que c'est. D'être obsédé d'indépendance, c'est de ma race, peut-être."
"Et ton mari, au Dagestan, te l'accorde, ta liberté?"
"C'est la maladie qui me la ronde. Me voilà à cet endroit pour la troisième fois. J'ai passé un an ici, cette fois. Possible que je revienne, mais alors tu seras bien loin depuis longtemps."
"You think so, Claudia?"
"Mon prénom aussi. Vraiment, tu le prends bien au sérieux. Les coutumes du carnaval."
"Then you know about my case too?"
"Oui, non. Comment c'est ces choses ici?
Tu as une petite tache humide là-dedans et un peu de fièvre, n'est-ce pas?"
37.8 ou 9 l'après-midi,"
said Hans Castorp. "And you?"
"Oh, mon cas, tu sais, c'est un peu plus compliqué, pas tout à fait simple. Il y a quelque chose dans cette branche de l'être humain, dite la médecine,"
Hans Castorp said, "qu'on appelle bouchement tuberculeuse des vases de lymphe."
"Ah, tu as moucharté, mon cher, on le voit bien. Et toi?"
"Forgive me, let me ask you a question. Ask it in all earnestness. 6 months ago, when I left the table for my first examination, you looked round after me. Do you remember?"
"Quelle question! Il y a 6 mois."
"Did you know where I was going?"
"Certes, c'était tout à fait par hasard."
"Berens had told you?"
"Toujours ce Berens. Oh, il a représenté ta peau d'une façon tellement exacte. D'ailleurs, c'est un veuf aux joues ardentes et qui possède un service à café très remarquable. Je crois bien qu'il connaît ton corps, non seulement comme médecin, mais aussi comme adepte d'une autre discipline de l'être humain."
"Tu as décidément raison de dire que tu parles en rêve, mon ami."
"Sois, laisse-moi rêver de nouveau, après m'avoir réveillé si cruellement par cette cloche d'alarme de ton départ. Sept-moi sous tes yeux, et à présent, où en réalité j'ai fait ta connaissance, tu me parles de départ. Je te répète que nous aurions pu causer plus tôt."
"You would have liked it?"
"Moi? Tu ne m'échapperas pas, mon petit. Il s'agit de tes intérêts à toi. Est-ce que tu étais trop timide pour t'approcher d'une femme à qui tu parles en rêve maintenant? Ou est-ce qu'il y avait quelqu'un qui t'en a empêché?"
"Je te l'ai dit, Je ne voulais pas te dire vous. Fasseur, réponds donc, ce monsieur beau parleur, cet Italien-là, qui a quitté la soirée. Est-ce qu'il t'a lancé tantôt?
Je n'en ai entendu absolument rien. Je me soucie très peu de ce monsieur, quand mes yeux te voient. Mais tu oublies, il n'aurait pas été si facile de tout de faire la connaissance dans le monde. Il y avait encore mon cousin, avec qui j'étais lié et qui incline très peu à s'amuser ici. Il ne pense à rien qu'à son retour dans les plaines pour se faire soldat.
Pauvre diable! Il est en effet plus malade qu'il ne sait. Ton ami italien, du reste, ne va pas trop bien non plus.
Il le dit lui-même. Mais mon cousin, est-ce vrai? Tout m'effraie.
Fort possible qu'il va mourir s'il essaie d'être soldat dans les plaines.
Qu'il va mourir, la mort, terrible mot, n'est-ce pas? Mais c'est étrange, il ne m'impressionne pas tellement aujourd'hui, ce mot. C'était une façon de parler bien conventionnelle lorsque je disais « tu m'effraies ». L'idée de la mort ne m'effraie pas, elle me laisse tranquille. Je n'ai pas pitié, ni de mon bon Joachim, ni de moi-même, en entendant qu'il va peut-être mourir. Si c'est vrai, son état ressemble beaucoup au mien, et je ne le trouve pas particulièrement imposant. Il est moribond, et moi, je suis amoureux, eh bien. Tu as parlé à mon cousin à l'atelier de photographie intime dans l'antichambre. Tu te souviens?
Je me souviens un peu.
Donc, ce jour-là, Berens a fait ton portrait transparent?
Mais oui. Mon Dieu! Et l'as-tu sur toi?
Non. Je l'ai dans ma chambre.
Ah, dans ta chambre. Quant au mien, je l'ai toujours dans mon portefeuille.
Veux-tu que je te le fasse voir?
Mille remerciements. Ma curiosité n'est pas invincible. Ce sera un aspect très innocent.
Moi, j'ai vu ton portrait extérieur. J'aimerais beaucoup mieux voir ton portrait intérieur qui est enfermé dans ta chambre.
Laisse-moi demander autre chose. Parfois, un monsieur russe qui loge en ville vient te voir.
Qui est-ce? Dans quel but vient-il, cet homme?
Tu es joliment fou en espionnage, je l'avoue.
Eh bien, je réponds, oui, c'est un compatriote souffrant, un ami. J'ai fait sa connaissance à une autre station balnéaire, il y a quelques années déjà. Nos relations? Les voilà. Nous prenons notre thé ensemble. Nous fumons deux ou trois papillons. Et nous bavardons, nous philosophons, nous parlons de l'homme, de Dieu, de la vie, de la morale, de mille choses.
Voilà mon compte rendu. Es-tu satisfait?
De la morale aussi. Est-ce que vous avez trouvé en fait de morale, par exemple?
La morale?
Cela t'intéresse?
Eh bien, il nous semble qu'il faudrait chercher la morale, non dans la vertu, c'est-à-dire dans la raison, la discipline, les bonnes mœurs, l'honnêteté, mais plutôt dans la contraire, je veux dire dans le péché et s'abandonnement au danger, à ce qui est nuisible, à ce qui nous consume. Il nous semble qu'il est plus moral de se perdre et même de se laisser dépérir que de se conserver. Les grands moralistes n'étaient point de vertueurs, mais des aventurés dans le mal, des vicieux, des grands pécheurs qui nous enseignent à nous incliner chrétiennement devant la misère. Tout ça doit te plaire beaucoup, n'est-ce pas?
He was silent, sitting as before with his feet entwined together, thrust back beneath the creaking wicker chair, leaning toward the figure opposite in its cocked hat, her pencil between his fingers. With Hans Lorenz Castorp's blue eyes, he looked out into the room. It was empty. The company dispersed. The piano in the corner, diagonally opposite, was being touched softly and lightly with one hand by the Mannheimer, by whose side sat Fräulein Engelhardt, turning the leaves of a music-book she held on her knee. At this pause which had ensued in the conversation between Hans Castorp and Claudia Schoscher, the pianist left off playing and sat with his hand in his lap, while Fräulein Engelhardt continued to turn the pages of her music-book. These four alone remained from all the carnival merrymakers. They sat here motionless. The silence lasted several minutes. Deeper and deeper under its weight sank the heads of the pair at the piano, his toward his keyboard, hers toward her book. But at last the two, as by common consent, stood up, cautiously, and carefully refraining from any glance in the direction of the opposite corner, their heads drawn down in their shoulders, their arms hanging stiffly at their sides, disappeared together, on tiptoe, through the writing-room.
"Everyone is going," said Frau Schoscher. "C'était les dernières. Il se fait tard. Eh bien, la fête du carnaval est finie."
She raised her arms to remove the paper cap from her head, with its reddish braid wound round it like a wreath.
"Vous connaissez les conséquences, monsieur?"
But Hans Castorp gainsaid them, closing his eyes and not otherwise changing his position. He answered,
"Jamais, Claudia. Jamais je te dirai vous. Jamais de la vie ni de la mort."
If one may say that, one should be able to.
"Cette forme de s'adresser à une personne qui est celle de l'occident cultivé et de la civilisation humanitaire me semble fort bourgeoise et pédante. Pourquoi, au fond, de la forme? La forme, c'est la pédanterie elle-même. Tout ce que vous avez fixé à l'égard de la morale, toi et ton compatriote souffrons. Tu veux sérieusement que ça me surprenne? Pour quelle sorte me prends-tu? Dis donc, qu'est-ce que tu penses de moi? C'est un sujet qui ne donne pas beaucoup à penser. Tu es un petit bonhomme convenable, de bonne famille, d'une tenue appétissante, disciple docile de ses précepteurs, et qui retournera bientôt dans les plaines pour oublier complètement qu'il a jamais parlé en rêve ici et pour aider à rendre son pays grande et puissante par son travail honnête sur le chantier. Voilà ta photographie intime, faite sans appareil. Tu la trouves exacte, j'espère? Il y a manque quelques détails que Berens y a trouvés. Ah, les médecins en trouvent toujours, ils s'y connaissent. Tu parles comme M. Settembrini. Et ma fièvre, d'où vient-elle? Allons donc, c'est un incident sans conséquence qui passera vite.
Non, Claudia, tu sais bien que ce que tu dis là n'est pas vrai, et tu le dis sans conviction, j'en suis sûr. La fièvre de mon corps et le battement de mon cœur harassé, et le frissonnement de mes membres, c'est le contraire d'incident, car ce n'est rien d'autre. And his pale face with the twitching lips bent closer over hers.
Rien d'autre que mon amour pour toi, oui. Cet amour qui m'a saisi à l'instant où mes yeux t'ont vu, ou plutôt que j'ai reconnu quand je t'ai reconnu toi. Et c'était lui, évidemment, qui m'a mené à cet endroit. Quelle folie! Oh, l'amour n'est rien, s'il n'est pas de la folie, une chose insensée, défendue et une aventure dans la malle. Autrement, c'est une banalité agréable, bonne pour en faire de petites chansons paisibles dans les plaines. Mais quant à ce que je t'ai reconnu et que j'ai reconnu mon amour pour toi, oui, c'est vrai, je t'ai déjà connu anciennement, toi et tes yeux merveilleusement obliques et ta bouche et ta voix avec laquelle tu parles, une fois déjà, lorsque j'étais collégien, je t'ai demandé ton crayon
pour faire enfin ta connaissance mondaine, parce que je t'aimais irraisonnablement, et c'est de là, sans doute, c'est de mon ancien amour pour toi, que ces manques me restent que Berens a trouvés dans mon corps et qui indiquent que jadis aussi j'étais malade.
His teeth stuck together. As he raved, he had drawn one foot from under his chair and moved it forward, so that the other knee touched the floor, where he kneeled before her, his head bent, his whole body quivering.
Je t'aime, he babbled. Je t'ai aimé de tout temps, car tu es le toit de ma vie, mon rêve, mon sort, mon envie, mon éternel désir. Allons, allons, she said, si tes précepteurs te voyaient.
But he shook his head violently, bowed as it was toward the carpet, and replied,
Je m'en ficherai. Je m'en fiche de tous ces carducci et de la République et la Comte et de progrès humain dans le temps, car je t'aime.
She caressed softly the close-cropped hair at the back of his head.
Petit bourgeois, she said, joli bourgeois, à la petite tache humide. Est-ce vrai que tu m'aimes tant?
And beside himself at her touch, now on both knees, with bowed head and closed eyes, he went on,
Oh, l'amour, tu sais, le corps, l'amour, la mort, ces trois ne font qu'un. Car le corps, c'est la maladie et la volupté, et c'est lui qui fait l'amour. Oui, ils sont charnels, tous deux, l'amour et la mort, et voilà leur terreur et leur grande magie. Mais la mort, tu comprends, c'est une part, une chose malfamée, impudente, qui fait rugir de honte. Et d'autre part, c'est une puissance très solennelle et très majestueuse, beaucoup plus haute que la vie riante, gagnant de la monnaie et facissant sa panse, beaucoup plus vénérable que le progrès qui bavarde par les tombes. Parce qu'elle est l'histoire et la noblesse et la pitié et l'éternel et le sacré qui nous fait tirer le chapeau et marcher sur la pointe des pieds. Or, de même, le corps, lui aussi, et l'amour du corps sont une affaire indécente et fâcheuse, et le corps rougit et pâlit à sa surface par frayeur et honte de lui-même. Mais aussi, il est une grande gloire adorable, image miraculeuse de la vie organique, sainte merveille de la forme et de la beauté, et l'amour pour lui, pour le corps humain, c'est de même un intérêt extrêmement humanitaire et une puissance plus éducative que toute la pédagogie du monde. Oh, enchantante beauté organique qui ne se compose ni de teinture à l'huile, ni de pierre, mais de matière vivante et corruptible, plein de secrets fébriles de la vie et de la pourriture. Regarde la symétrie merveilleuse de l'édifice humain, les épaules et les hanches et les mamelons fleurissants de part et d'autre sur la poitrine, et les côtes arrangées par paires, et le nombril au milieu dans la mollesse du ventre, et le sexe obscur entre les cuisses. Regarde les omoplates se remuer sous la peau soyeuse du dos, et l'échine qui descend vers la luxuriance double et fraîche des fesses, et des grandes branches de vase, et des nerfs qui passent du tronc au rameau par les aisselles, et comme la structure des bras corresponde à celle des jambes. Oh, les douces régions de la jointure intérieure de coude et de jarret, avec leur abondance de délicatesse organique sous leur coussin de chair. Quelle fête immense de le caresser, ces endroits délicieux du corps humain. Faites à mourir sans plainte après. Oui, mon Dieu, laisse-moi sentir l'odeur de la peau de ta rotule, sous laquelle l'ingénieuse capsule articulaire sécrète son huile glissante. Laisse-moi toucher dévotement de ma bouche la teria fémoralis qui bat au front de ta cuisse et qui se divise plus bas et en les deux artères du tibia. Laisse-moi ressentir l'exhalation de tes pores et tâter ton duvet, image humaine, d'eau et l'albumine, destinée pour l'anatomie du tombeau, et laisse-moi périr mes lèvres aux tiennes.
He did not stir or open his eyes. On his knees, with bowed head, his hands holding the silver pencil outstretched before him, he remained swaying and quivering.
She said, Tu es en effet un galant qui s'est sollicité d'une manière profonde à l'allemande.
And she set the paper cap on his head.
Adieu, mon prince carnaval. Vous aurez une mauvaise ligne de fièvre ce soir. Je vous le prédis.
She slipped from her chair and glided over the carpet to the door, where she paused an instant, framed in the doorway, half turned toward him, with one bare arm lifted high, her hand upon the hinge. Over her shoulder she said softly,
N'oubliez pas de me rendre mon crayon,
and went out. End of section 48. End of volume 1 of The Magic Mountain. Read by Steve Goff, April 2022 to April 2023.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on your next outdoor project at Menards. Menards has the best in-stock selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber. Our huge inventory of decking, fencing, lumber, and timbers are all easy to load in our drive-through lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our fence and deck design programs in-store or online at Menards.com. Don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money.